Welcome to the Midlife Movement podcast, where we're challenging the narrative on aging, one story at a time. Hi everybody, it's Jo here from the Midlife Movement, and with me this week is Clarissa Christensen, who is a mindfulness in menopause expert. Hi Clarissa.
Hello Jo, I'm so delighted to be here.
Are you coming from Sweden?
I am, yes.
Yes. Lovely. I've been looking forward to having Clarissa on my podcast for some time now. The pandemic got in the way, didn't it, of us connecting?
Just a little bit, just a wee bit, you know. So that we kept saying, yes, we're going to do this. And then the pandemic and COVID and house moves and a lot of things meant that we didn't quite get to where we wanted to be. But we're here now, and that's the main thing.
So tell us, Clarissa, I know that you run a very successful podcast. What's the name of your podcast?
My podcast is called Thriving Through Menopause, and it's really about holistic health around menopause. So we do have a few doctors, but we talk to a lot of other people because, well, you know, menopause has many different facets to it. It isn't all just about, I've got a symptom, I take a drug. There's the whole of our life around it, past and current, that we are able to do some things about.
Absolutely. I love the positive title of that, Thriving Through Menopause. I think we've been very much focusing on the negative side of menopause recently.
Yeah.
I mean, although it's got us talking about it more, which we needed to do, I think we've got a little bit stuck in that negativity, haven't we?
I think we've got stuck in the one fix stop shop. I mean, and I always preface that, even though it sounds a bit weak, that I'm not in a binary camp. We're not in anti-HRT versus HRT. That's ridiculous to be in that. What we want to be saying is the person's in the middle, and the person needs to have the most choice and solutions they can. And if we only talk about symptoms, we're only talking about a small part of our life because, you know, this is a few years. It seems long, and it can, for some women it can be, but for a lot of us, it's about a 5 to 6 year period. In the span of our total life, and knowing that we're going to live 30 to 50 years on the other side of our menopause, we shouldn't be using the kind of language we use. It's fear-based, it's disempowering. And actually, we should be saying, yeah, it's tough, but these are ways that you can do it. This is what you can do. This is where you can get help. And when it's over, you know, life opens up for something completely different. As you and I both know, Jo, being, you know, a little bit
the other side.
45, 50.
Yes. I mean, when I started to go through it at 44, so this was some 16, 17 years ago. It wasn't being spoken about, and I didn't have a clue that that was what was going on. It was purely for me, it was neurological symptoms, mostly that feeling of dread and sudden anxiety about things I'd never been anxious about before, and depression and things like that. But I think the depression came from not knowing what was going on, and, you know, and so on. But the reaction then was to go to the doctor, be given antidepressants, go away, and you'll get through the other side. Nowadays, it doesn't have to be HRT or not HRT. You can actually have a combination and take control yourself, can't you?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, when we listen to the different types of people who work in this area, we know that nutrition is really, really important. Our gut's an important part of it. Our mental health, and also things like exercise, rest, all of those are important factors in this. And HRT can do wonderful things, but it doesn't do everything. And it isn't always as easy a journey as some people would like to make out. I mean, I read hundreds of Facebook messages every week, and women saying things like, well, it worked for a while and now it doesn't work. Or I've been on it for 5 months and it's not working. Or it's worked fantastically for this, but this has happened. It's like any medication. There are side effects, and none of them are perfect. If they were all perfect, we'd take one or two pills in our life and we go, way, but we know that's not really how it is. And so we can really do so much to help ourselves by being open and curious and asking questions and trying different things.
I absolutely agree. I think that HRT is seen as a magic bullet in some quarters, and it's just a part of the arsenal of weapons that you have to, well, that's battle language for you. Perhaps I didn't mean to go down that way, but it's part of your toolbox, and shouldn't be seen as the be-all and end-all.
No.
Just recycling back to nutrition, I think it's only really been in the last sort of 15 years or so that we've really realised how much the gut can affect mental health, isn't it?
Oh, it's huge. And I think we're still uncovering that gut-brain connection and learning about the gut microbiome and how much that really determines our well-being on a whole body, and this whole journey around inflammation, gut inflammation, and inflammation that can flow from there into your brain. You know, it's new science, it's exciting, but it's still evolving, and I don't think we fully understand it all.
No, I think you're right there. And movement. Now, we all know that we need to exercise, but who knew how important it was as you go through midlife?
No, I mean, who knew really that, you know, cardio was kind of not the thing you should be focused on, having been sucked in those messages about heart health, and that it was really strength training in whatever form you do it. I mean, that's like, wow, that is new, and we're embracing that. We're also embracing the power of yoga and Pilates, which of course in their own way are strength training, but they're a bit more than that, that kind of mind body connection again coming through those practices.
Absolutely. I mean, I see yoga as meditation in movement, you know, because you really tune into your body, and you can feel what's going on in your body and where it is in space and time as well. So it's a very, very beneficial. And walking. I mean, I've seen so many people, so many women who have been runners, and some women it's fine, they carry on running, but and they're fine with it. But others, you can see the pain it causes with that impact. And actually, we don't have to be hot and sweaty all the time to be exercising in the right way.
No, absolutely not. I mean, we can a good walk every day is good for us physically and mentally. I mean, that's how, you know, people move naturally in the past. If we think about some of the hunter-gatherers, I was reading a book about exercise and movement. And the guy there, I think he's a neuropsychiatrist or physiologist or what, I'm not really 100% sure now, from Harvard. And he talks about how people in traditional societies walk 10,000 steps, how much they bend down, pick up, carry. And we forget about that. We're doing a lot of that. And if we can do more of that, it's brilliant. But there's, you know, there's a big gap between average sitting all day and actually being out and walking. So we have to be a bit more deliberate about our 10,000 steps.
I mean, the 10,000 steps things, that's quite an arbitrary figure, isn't it? I mean, has it been proved to be something that's beneficial?
Well, not 100%. We think that when you look at traditional societies, that's roughly about what they walk in a day, if you put a pedometer on them. But it's kind of arbitrary. I mean, I think the important thing is to get out and walk. And 10,000 is quite a lot, actually, to fit into a day. But I mean, the average person walks about 2,000. So I suppose anything that you do over
absolutely
a lot better, you know. And I think, you know, I've for years managed to always walk about 7,000 and really have to push to do the extra three.
I tend to, when I'm fully fit, I tend to do about 8,000 a day. But what one thing I found interesting, because it's not just actually going out for a walk, it's your day-to-day movement, isn't it? It's just movement as opposed to exercise, which is so beneficial. And when I broke my ankle a few months ago and being completely immobilized, I didn't realize how much I jump up and down all day. I thought I just sat and you know, at my computer, but I don't. I'm always jumping up and down.
And I think that's what we can do. We can get up. I work downstairs, so I have to go upstairs to get coffee or water or something. So actually, that's a huge part for me. Up and down the stairs a few times, might take the dog out. You might go to the bin, you go up and around your house. That's all movement. I mean, cleaning your house is movement. We don't always love doing that, but it's very good physical movement. Walking around the shops, all of that is actual physical movement that adds to the total number of steps you do in a day.
Yeah, fabulous. It's so much more doable. I don't know about you, but I don't have any ambitions to run a marathon, but I do like to run around the park with my grandkids. You know, it's functional fitness, isn't it?
That it is definitely. It's that ability to say, well, what's my real goal? Very few of us are really in reality saying, I want to run a marathon, just like you said there, Joe. But lots of us would like to play in the park with our grandchildren, would like to walk our dogs, might like to go on a short hiking holiday. And obviously, some of us would like to be able to still tie our shoes and be, you know, unsupported as we get much older. And that begins now.
Balance as well. That's key, isn't it? To work on our balance now. I fall over a lot, hence the broken ankle. And that's definitely something that I need to work on a lot more.
I've noticed that since I did more strength training, that I've built a much stronger core. And where I live, it's not flat. I mean, it's out in the Swedish countryside. It's a bit unmanicured by, shall we say, British standards. But, you know, I can now get up and down over rocks and scramble with a dog and she pulls like a tank. But I'm not as worried now. And I'm far less likely to fall over simply because I've been have more core strength.
Yeah. So another reason to make sure you do your strength training and get that core nice and strong, not to mention the pelvic floor. It helps with the pelvic floor as well, doesn't it?
It does.
So the you've got a new book out. I know you wrote the book, The Mindful Menopause, which you were saying is coming out in audiobook. When does that come out?
It's coming out in July. In July. Audio format, which will be lovely because then you can tune and listen to the meditations. It's very exciting, I think.
Yes. Oh, I shall look forward to that. I love a good meditation. Try and fit one in my day as much as I try and fit jumping up and down and going for walks and so on. I think that it is, isn't it, sort of thinking about that holistic view of your own health and well-being becomes so much more important as we reach this age and beyond. But you've got another book out, The Potent Power of Menopause, pardon me, looking at my notes and getting them all muddled. Tell us about that.
Well, that's an anthology. I joined forces with Dawn Bates, who is a very well-known author. I think this is her 17th book, so super impressed by Dawn's, you know, persistence in this area. And we met a number of years as she was a podcast guest of mine. And we started that project. And it is 11 humans. 10 of them were women and a man from his perspective. They come from all around the world to really share different perspectives on their own menopause journey. Our oldest author is 80. She lives in rural Australia. And she has actually launched a podcast and a coaching course when she was 79. So there you are. So anybody who uses words like deficient and depleted or whatever there is, I think you might be a bit mistaken if you met Dan. And our youngest author is still in her 30s and she lives in India. And she actually had a hysterectomy while we were writing the book. But the book is really about positivity around menopause, because even though the authors have, many of them, experienced a very difficult transition, many of them come out with their lives so changed if for the better because of the menopause journey that they've been on.
That's a really powerful message. I'm interested as well that you culturally, it's culturally diverse, because I'm interested in how different societies treat aging, and particularly aging in women. Did you find through that there was a difference between Western societies and maybe Eastern societies?
Yes, I mean, and particularly if we listen to like Maggie's story from India, how she talks about it from an Ayurvedic perspective and how they want women to move from this sort of powerful, focused on your family and career to the time of being a little calmer and letting yourself rest and allowing this to unfold. and then really opening up to a new way of being where you're more focused on you than on other people. So that's really beautiful. And actually Ulis, who is from Sweden, but she's a yogi too, they both share kind of similar perspectives on that. Mm. But some of our people are culturally diverse because some have never had any children. Mm. Some have worked in corporate, others haven't worked in corporate. So the diversity is beyond just their, should we say, their ethnicity, but also by the experiences that people have had.
And that's interesting, isn't it? As you say, it's not just about location or geography or ethnicity. I find this in the midlife movement. It's there's a debate very often about, because I mean, my own personal experience, I've had four children, and so empty nest and all that sort of thing is something that I'm used to. But women who haven't had children, there are other issues that come in there once we reach menopause. And I think it's about supporting each other, isn't it, through all these diverse experiences and pulling together through all of that. Yeah. It's I remember years ago, you know, you'd have the whole debate between the way you fed your baby, you know, and people were set up to sort of be against each other, you know, and it's crazy, you know, let's just all support each other.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's a bit of that, as we said earlier, going on in menopause too, unfortunately.
Yes.
Binary camps. But actually, if we could all just pull together and put the person in the middle, the person who's not coping that well or who needs more advice and support, then we'd all know that we can all contribute to the greater well-being of the individual and of all of us.
Mm. And it's about supporting choice as well. I mean, that is what it comes down to at the end of the day, for us to be able to make informed choices. How did you go through your transitionary period?
Yeah, well, we were probably at a similar a sort of age when this started for me. I was about 45 and I didn't know what perimenopause was. I mean, I knew what menopause was because my mother had been through it. She'd had a pretty horrific time. She had hormonal migraines, but I was so busy with life. And I actually had a marriage breakup and I moved to Australia. You know, crazy things you do with a small child and a dog. So my life was pretty busy. And then I noticed some changes that I didn't know were connected to perimenopause. Some of them for me were mental, a lot of anxiety, which is incredibly common. And I kind of now understand that I'd always been an anxiety sister, if we like, rather than sufferer. I had come through that journey, you know, being very focused and driven, but that didn't work so well for me. My sleep was disrupted, and I picked up things that I didn't expect. I didn't realize that things like thrush and BV were actually part of the change in your microbiome. And so you think you've picked up something else and think, oh, what's going on here? But in fact, those sort of things together with acid reflux, I didn't know that they were connected to hormones because no one talked about it. And your clinician didn't talk about it either.
No, I don't think a lot of clinicians knew that these things were connected. And I think even now, sometimes you know, the training on menopause for your average general practitioner is really deficient. So I think that very often it's up to us to educate ourselves about what our symptoms can be attributed to, so that we know what questions to ask if we do end up in the doctor's office. I just wanted to speak to one of the things that you mentioned earlier, and that was rest. Now, 15 years ago, we weren't talking about the importance of rest or sunlight or, you know, or anything like that, were we?
Not to the same extent that we are now.
No.
I think this whole movement of yin yoga, restorative yoga and yoga nidra were kind of, and the need to rest and self-nurture were not mainstream conversation.
No.
So you were meant to plow on, keep going, not moan, and just get on with it, basically, a bit like our mothers and grandmothers had. Although in some ways, women who didn't work, which was more maybe our grandmother's generation, they actually sit down and have a cup of tea and put the feet up in the afternoons before the kids came home. But we don't do that. We've sort of been sucked into a man's world when we work like a man all day, and then we come home and we still do what women have always had to do, which is care for children if you have them, keep the house tidy, care for aging parents, and we're exhausted.
Absolutely. There's definitely with the coaching that I do, it's a lot of it is about the energy that we can, a different energy that we can use, rather than be trying to push all the time. And it's all very interesting. It's certainly revolutionized the way I do things. After we've finished this podcast, before I edit it, I shall go and sit in the garden with my cup of tea, listen to the birds, get some sun on my face, and rest. And like you say, put your feet up, because we're allowed to. I think that, you know, as I grew up, it was very much, if my mum saw me sitting and reading, it was, why don't you do something useful? You know, don't be lazy. And these little words go in your head, don't they, you know, about being lazy.
Australia, the good thing about living in Australia was that Australians love holidays and they love weekends on the beach. And I think that was probably part of supporting me more than looking back than it ever did. Of course, the weather's nice and you can go to a nice beach in the morning or after work and things like that. And they do know how to chill out like that. Take three or 4 weeks summer holiday, which is not what I think the UK does, but still parts of Europe do.
Yes. I mean, it's certainly not in the US, the culture certainly isn't to take holidays at all, is it?
No.
You know, it's not a good place for women to thrive, particularly women in midlife, because we do need more rest and we need to break it up into manageable chunks as well through the day, you know. And it doesn't mean that you have to go and, you know, spend an hour, but, you know, just 10 minutes, as you say, with a cup of tea, that's a little break in the day, helps us mentally as well as physically. So the power of mindfulness through menopause, how did you get involved in mindfulness?
Well, actually, I had a horrible panic attack in the office and I was very, very upset. Obviously, it happened in front of a very senior manager and I realized that I had to make some changes. And I happened to have met somebody who was a mindfulness teacher and the organization she worked for was just in the next suburb from me. So I went and I initially trained in mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is the traditional modern mindfulness course, and I noticed improvements in myself and my life, in my anxiety, my ability to sleep, and my ability to exercise and focus and do things like that I hadn't done in the same way. And it was very good for my menopause symptoms. I trained then to also be a breathworks teacher, so I work also with areas like chronic pain, which is quite common for women in menopause, and then became really aware that all the women I was working with, because they were mostly women, an occasional man would drift through the door who couldn't sleep or was highly stressed, were women in midlife. They were struggling with mental health conditions, pain conditions, lack of sleep, and a general sense that life wasn't going where they wanted it to. And then I actually trained under Jenny Burrell in menopause as a sort of holistic health coach. And that gives me kind of the two stools, because I obviously know my mindfulness, but they also understand what's going on in women's bodies hormonally, what's changing. And then I started to bring the two together into the work that I do in the books and the workshops and talks that I do around mindfulness and the menopause.
The workshops that you do, are they do you take them into the workspace, or are they sort of personal?
They tend to be more personal. People come. The way I work is that I do run workshops, which can be quite short. I do run longer training sessions for smaller groups of women, particularly if they're struggling with gynecological pain related issues, which can be menopausal and not menopausal, shall we say. Then we work in small, very tight groups together.
So once we've got through menopause, or perimenopause, I should say, and we're postmenopausal, do you think that we can take, how do we take the mindfulness practice forward into the later part of our lives?
Yeah, I think having an anchor, and I think the first thing to say actually is that brains upgrade. That's the one thing we now know, that our brains do become much better. we have more focus and concentration. We drop a lot of the multitasking, which helps with the anxiety. But mindfulness, I think, helps us to accept that we are aging when we live in such a youth-focused society. Mm. And mindfulness is also a lot about connection. And we know that to age well, we need a different social connection than we had when we were maybe younger. We can be more transient when we're young. We can be a bit on our own. But connection and acceptance are huge aspects of our of aging, because a lot of older people are very lonely. That can bring on depression and a lack of interest in life and what life has to bring. So I think mindfulness is that. And mindfulness is also about things like mindful movement, because eventually we're not going to be pumping weights and running marathons. I know there are women that's in men who are still doing that. But as we age, mindful movements like Qigong and yoga become more central to our life. And then that's that combination of moving and conscious thought and breath. And that can be very, very good for us as we get older in terms of our total health.
It also helps with the social connection, doesn't it? If you're going to a yoga class or a Qigong class and so on, that helps with that. So when you say connection, you mean social connection?
I think there's a connection to yourself and listening to yourself as well. But I think there's also that social togetherness, whether you join a meditation group, go to Qigong, go to yoga, through a mindful practice, you're enhancing your sense of connection.
It's that shared activity and that shared interest. Because I've had women say to me before, how do I make new friends? You know, I'm now that I'm sort of 60, and I'm alone, and how am I going to make new friends? And we live in such a fast society, don't we? Especially if we're still working. It's very difficult to find that space to connect with people. Do you have any advice for people to do? Of how to connect in a mindful way?
I think finding things that really resonate with your purpose, with your values, is very important. Of course, we're not out pubbing and clubbing and dancing and dating. Well, we might be dating, actually. Why yes. not? But we are maybe looking for something that is more aligned to who we are, and areas of service, because I think that's where older people can do so much. As we age, what can we do for our community, whether that's local or global? What could we be part of giving back, sharing our wisdom? Mm. And opportunities like that are amazing. And I see that with the older people I know, how much they give back to their communities in various ways. And that is so valuable to our society.
It is, isn't it? And it's valuable to the individual, because we all need a purpose. And I think that when our working lives come towards the end, a lot of people find it very difficult to find purpose, don't they? And that's definitely a great way to reconnect with a purpose and reconnect with ourselves and society on the whole.
I have so much to give, Jo. I mean, it was interesting. I did a podcast guest training show program, and so many of the people who wanted to be guests were people in their 70s and 80s, because they have skills and wisdom to share that the world can benefit. So I think it's part of us also being open to allowing those people in. I mean, they can master technology, believe you me. Obviously, as I said, Anne, who is our author in our book, but also lots and lots of other older people that I've met who are starting podcasts, who are writing books, who are giving talks. There's no end to what we can do. We're only limited by our physical health, really.
Yes, and also we can be limited by our own attitudes, can't we? You know, if we think we can't, then we definitely can't. Send these people my way, because I love talking to people with wisdom to share. Is there anything that you would like to add about mindfulness and menopause before we close today?
I think making time to do mindful practices, you know, that it 15 minutes a day could change your brain for the better. So even if you do feel foggy, anxious, emotional, you're struggling with your sleep. We know that mindfulness changes your brain and can dial down a lot of those things. And, you know, not just by doing it and being mindful, but actually it's changing your actual brain. And that is highly beneficial for you in perimenopause and beyond.
I'm just going to, just before we close, when you say a mindful practice for 15 minutes a day, what do you actually mean by a mindful practice? Just in case anybody listening isn't sure what mindfulness is.
A short exercise, a short meditation practice, if you like. You can do something on a Headspace or Calm app. You could take a mindful walk, but you could also play music. You could spend time doing something like, you know, mindful colouring or making mandalas, or actually one of the best ones is macrame, because you put away your phone, and especially if you're like me and you're all fingers and thumbs, you can actually do something. I mean, you can use activities that you do in your everyday, but just do them without the interruption of social media and other people, and give yourself that time and space.
So that's the key, is when you're doing something, to do it 100%. And to be totally focused on that thing that you're doing and not be trying to multitask.
Indeed. And allowing whatever's coming up is coming up to be there. You know, if it feels a bit tough and you want to have a cry, well, that's fine. That's you're okay. You're always okay meeting your emotions and whatever happens without having to judge it. Just be curious about yourself and what's going on for you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. It's really interesting, you know, that something as simple as mindfulness can ease that journey through the transition and help you thrive through menopause and beyond.
Indeed. Thank you, Jo, for having me as a guest.